Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am the tech editor here at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as usual, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Actually, I am also Chris Paulette.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm just seeing if I can get away with it.
That's not true.
No, it's not true.
I can see right through that.
It leads to our listener mail. This listener mail comes from Boris, or, if you wish, Bobcat. And I do wish. So this listener mail comes from Bobcat, who says, "Hello, beloved techies. First of all, I have to say that I really appreciated the rant and other outbursts of skepticism in your ghost hunting technology episode. There's been a profound absence of critical thinking and evidence-based positions on various issues coming from the media lately, and your show has definitely made me feel as if there's hope for rationality and non-wackiness. So kudos, you've made at least one listener as happy as pie. If you are considering doing more podcasts with related undertones of skepticism, I suggest that you guys consider taking on things like radiometric dating technologies as well as lie detectors and the technology of spying. That is, how some believe that the government may be watching us and how they actually do. Also, during the sci-fi movies podcast from before, you brought up Dollhouse in passing. Still can't believe it's over. Why cover movies for a podcast, not do TV shows? And then rub it in our faces by mentioning Dollhouse. I expect this gross malfeasance to be corrected as soon, or malfeasance, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
My brain is not working. Should be corrected soon and with one of those annoying listener mail announcements from Strickland. Thanks for maintaining your high standard of podcastiness, except for the fact that I mispronounced malfeasance. Well, Boris, thanks a lot. We actually decided from this email to take one specific a suggestion, which was the lie detector suggestion. I thought that was an excellent suggestion. We can talk about how they work and how they do not work, because they do both at the same time, as it turns out.
I'm sorry, I was still thinking about pie.
Yeah, I was still thinking of Malfiessence. So, and Suburbia.
Yeah,
but that was,
50 podcasts ago when you said Suburbia?
I know. You know, once in a while I drop a bomb like that, and then I beat myself up over it for the next, 3 months.
Apparently.
So, anyway, yeah, let's talk about polygraphs, lie detectors.
Oh, those highly calibrated machines that it takes, a trained forensic psychophysiologist weeks to learn.
Yeah,
how to use.
Yeah, it could take you up to 14 whole weeks to learn how to operate one of these things. Wow. All right, before we get too far, let's make some things very clear. First of all, lie detectors do in fact measure things. They're not just it's not just a box with some little pens that scribble on a paper randomly. It's not like it's just a fake tool. What they do is they measure physiological responses over a set period of time, the set period being whenever you turn the machine on and whenever you turn the machine off.
Mm-hmm.
But it does this through three main methods. It measures your respiratory rate. That would be the respiratory right there is Chris breathing heavily into his microphone.
Breathing heavily into the microphone.
It's just, I'm
breathing lightly into the microphone.
If any of you found that creepy, write techstuff at howstuffworks.com. I know I will be. And then it also measures your pulse rate. It has a pressure cuff on your arm. Oh, my God.
Hey, you know, I'm being
okay,
a percussionist. I want to do the Foley work.
As the person who is sitting here in the studio with Chris at this time, I can't wait to see what he has to do about this one.
I got nothing for this next one.
The third thing it measures is galvanic response, which technically is sweating. And
yeah,
well,
I got
you know
nothing
what?
For that.
Yeah, Chris is always sweating buckets, so it's kind of hard to tell from one moment to the next if he's actually, trying to display something, if he's trying to illustrate a point. But that's just a
joke.
Eat it,
Joe's.
He's not really sweating. So they do this through various methods. There's there's one that'll be sensors that are placed around your chest to measure your chest's expansion and contraction as you're breathing.
That would be the respiratory rate part.
That would be the respiratory rate. There's a pressure cuff placed along one arm that measures the pulse.
That would be the blood pressure and heart rate.
And then there are electrodes attached to the fingers to measure the galvanic response, the amount of sweat.
Yes.
Okay. So
and they have a bucket underneath the table, so if it gets out of hand.
Yeah. When Muggsy comes in, they're like, "Okay, we got a sweater. Let's put a bucket under there." So these are always measuring these changes in these rates. They have to establish a baseline first, and any change in any of those three factors will result in a needle on the paper scribbling something so that you can actually see where the changes happen along the set time period.
Yeah, I think we've all seen a movie or TV show where they've done that close-up shot and the little needle going.
Right, the needle starts shaking back and forth really crazy in case any of you can't hear that. You know what? We should just leave it to Liz to put in the little scratchy sounds because I bet that picks up a lot better than you scratching on your laptop.
I don't know. They can pick up footsteps outside the studio.
That's true. We have heard Bigfoot lurking outside our studio occasionally.
Anyway.
But at any rate, okay, so yeah, these – it's not just one line of data. It's actually several lines of data because you get one essentially for each factor. So there are three different needles measuring it. And ideally, you would be able to look at the three different lines and be able to tell when there was a major change in someone's physiological response.
Well, there's sort of a hypothetical basis on which you could say if somebody was lying, you would expect them to be more stressed out than if they were telling the truth.
That's
because they're concerned with preventing the truth from coming out.
Right. That's what the whole basis of polygraph is that's the foundation for the polygraph test. The foundation for the polygraph test is an assumption that if you lie about something, you will your body will engage in the fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm.
Not to take something from our sister podcast Stuff You Should Know. That's their favorite phrase, or it used to be anyway. But the fight or flight response tends to pop into play whenever you are trying to conceal something. At least that's the theory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if this were to hold true, if every single person in the world were to respond in a similar way whenever they were trying to be elusive or lie about something, then the lie detector test might actually work. if everyone responded the same way.
Right.
But we're human beings. Turns out we all have different responses to the same sort of sensory input. Some of us get very anxious at times, including myself. There are certain situations where I get very, very anxious.
Sure.
And I'm certain that if I were ever brought in to be questioned about something, I would be very anxious about it. Not because necessarily that I did something. I'm not saying I did, and I'm not saying I didn't. I'm just saying
that. You can't prove anything.
Yeah. But in either case, even if I were completely innocent of it, I know that people asking me these questions would make me nervous, and my body would react in such a way that it would be very difficult to say that a reading that you got from me would indicate a lie versus truth, just because I would be anxious no matter if I had done it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, there are people out there who are consummate liars, and either they are delusional and actually believe the things they're saying, they're sociopaths, they don't care what they're saying, or they've trained themselves to not give away these physiological responses so that it's very difficult to tell whether or not they're telling the truth. Everything looks like the truth.
It's kind of fascinating to think that there are actually people that are, you know, that actually believe that what they are saying is true, even when it's, you know, a patent lie.
Yeah.
But, you know, if somebody is delusional about that and believes that what they are saying is true, then they're not going to register any kind of response like that.
Right.
They believe it to be true.
And as time passes, it's easier and easier to believe mm-hmm. a lie. And in some cases when I'm saying lie, it may just be an exaggeration. For example, if you think about something that happened to you in your childhood and you tell the story about it, and it's one of those things that I've mentioned this before. It can mm-hmm. build over time. Like you elaborate the story and you might exaggerate one fact over another, or you might add in a little thing that didn't necessarily happen, but it makes the story better.
Mm-hmm.
And upon retellings and over the passage of time, you might actually come to believe that that is actually exactly how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you were to review, say, a film of it or a video of it, you might be shocked to see how different the real event was from the way it was in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd been given a polygraph test and you were asked to relay that information under the polygraph system, it would show that you're telling the truth, because mm-hmm. you're saying what you believe. There's no magic in the box that allows it to determine what is really true and what isn't.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the process of a polygraph examination and kind of explain, you know, how these examiners build a routine so that they can try and track lies.
Right. Now, actually, when I was commenting earlier when we got started about the forensic psychophysiologist, I was hoping to say it without tripping that time. Those are the people who like to who like to be known that way. That is their professional title, I guess. But they are the people who give the polygraph tests.
Right.
And really, a professional forensic psychophysiologist, hey, if I don't look at the words, make them out easier. They are generally going through some kind of professional training, such as the Axitron International Academy, which is accredited by the American Polygraph Association and certified by the American Association of Police Polygraphists, people who give polygraphs.
Polygraphists sound like people who have more than one graph.
That's true.
I'm a monographist myself.
So if you were going to become a forensic psychophysiologist,
shame on you.
Yeah. You would need to have a baccalaureate degree, or at least 5 years of investigative experience and an associate's degree. You would need to go through a certified course, which includes among the different categories you would need to study are psychology, physiology, ethics, history, question construction, speech analysis, chart analysis, text and test data analysis. And you would also have to, go through a series of exams to, you know, on actual cases in which a lie detector test, or I should say polygraph, is being used. And those are reviewed by professionals. So this internship can, although the program is sort of short, the internship can take from 8 months to a year, according to the article we have on the website about how lie detectors work.
Yeah, it's actually a very good article. I do recommend that you read it. So that all being kind of beside the point, really, when you get down to to what exactly is going on with lie detectors. But
I just wanted to point out that there is some – that the people who are actually doing this for, say, a police department or another law enforcement agency go through training on how to interpret – what they think is coming out of the machine.
Right. The problem is that, again, the very foundation of what they do is faulty. It's built on a false premise. Ultimately, it's built on a false premise.
Right. I just wanted to talk about how the process works. Okay, yes, so let's talk about the test itself.
Okay, so during the test itself, what would happen is the examiner would, you know, strap you in. Mm-hmm. So let's say that that I, Jonathan Strickland, am the subject of this polygraph examination.
Okay.
The first thing that would happen is that usually you get a few questions at the beginning that are supposedly to form the baseline so that the questioner can see what your level of anxiety is just based upon normal questions, nothing that necessarily has anything to do with what they brought you in for.
They want to see basically what's moving the needles when they tell it, say, or ask you, versus what isn't moving the needle, so they can get an idea of how you're going to behave.
Right. If you're already anxious, then this would theoretically at least let them know, okay, this guy's kind of a nervous Nelly, so anything that hits this level doesn't necessarily mean it's a lie because this dude's just quivering in his boots, which is exactly how I would be. I'm not going to lie. I'm about that. Anyway, so they would ask me a series of questions, supposedly to create a baseline. Now, this is debatable whether or not this actually, you know, makes any real difference. Mm-hmm. Next, what they would probably do is ask a control question.
Right.
And this would be a simple question where it's just to measure your response. And then they would alternate that with a question that actually relates back to what they're looking into.
Right. And that would be why they ask the people who are training to work with polygraphs to learn about question construction, because they want to learn how to phrase different topics in ways to see if they can get a response from you.
Yeah. So you get your design questions, or what they're called.
Right.
For the ones that have to do with your actual the purpose for the polygraph.
Right.
So let's say, like, the first question might be, is your name Jonathan Strickland? And I would say yes. And then the next question might be,
yes. No. I don't know.
And then I'd pee myself. But the next question might be, more pertinent to whatever the matter is. For instance, were you in the Buckhead neighborhood on Tuesday night? Mm-hmm. And then I would say either yes or no. And then if they suspect that I was there and I said no, they would look at the chart to see if the response on that question was measurably different from my response to the control questions. Because if I'm answering the control questions honestly, and they should be able to know that, because the control question should be obvious, right? Mm-hmm. It should be very obvious questions like, are there two people in the room with us? And you'd say yes or no. If you are lying to an obvious question, then they can tell pretty quickly if you're going to be able to fool the polygraph, which, by the way, is very possible.
Mm-hmm.
So they alternate these questions. They will ask a control question now and again just to make sure that that they're reading the results correctly. And then they will ask one of the design questions to see if you are telling the truth or not. You can get through an entire polygraph lying your butt off the whole way through, and if you are able to control your responses, or you're able to boost your responses to control questions to show that you are a nervous Nelly, either of those are going to make the results unreliable. They're not going to be able to say this guy for sure was lying or was telling the truth. So, for instance, if they asked me, is your name Jonathan Strickland? And I said yes, but I was able to provoke myself into reacting in a more heightened way, it would indicate that I had lied on that, even though I had told the truth. And this could all be I can manage to do this on my own. So in other words, I could fabricate it as if it looks like it's a lie. And then the next question they ask me, were you in Buckhead on Tuesday night? And I say, no. I could just relax a little bit, and then it'll come up as not being a lie. And then they'll look at the results and say, well, according to this, I mean, we asked him this control question. He told the truth, but his response was off the charts. Then we asked him this question and he said no. And his response was calm. Clearly he's just nervous. We can't rely on this as information to establish whether or not he's guilty,
mm-hmm.
or if he's telling the truth or not. So really, when you get down to it, once you understand that, you realize the polygraph is not a reliable tool for telling truth versus lies. That doesn't mean that the polygraph isn't useful if you are willing to use some psychological bullying to try and get a confession out of someone.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's incredibly useful if you want to try and get a confession out of someone. And as long as that person believes that the lie detector is doing its job and is working properly,
mm-hmm.
It can be incredibly effective at getting a confession. But it's almost like a confession under duress, if you think about it, because the person's being fooled into thinking this device is doing more than it really is.
Well, how are you going to fool somebody into believing that it actually works?
All right. I mean,
what could they do?
Here's a good example. This is not necessarily how everyone does it, but mm-hmm. there are law enforcement officials who have done this or examiners who have done this. You do a very simple card trick, but you don't present it as a card trick.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you present the person who's being questioned. You present that person with a deck of cards and say, pick a card, look at it, memorize it, put it back in the deck, you know, however you want to do it. And then you deal the cards out face up and you just tell the person, just say that it's not your card. Whether it's your card or not, say it's not your card. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So each card that comes up, you're saying, no, that's not it. No, that's not it. Till you go through the whole deck. Then the person goes back to supposedly look at the results on the polygraph, comes back and then says, according to the polygraph, this is your card. And they hold up the card that you picked. And then you're convinced, oh my gosh, not only does this thing work, it can actually work to the point where it can tell the difference of one response out of 52 questions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in reality, the examiner has just used a very, very basic card trick, and there are many different ways of doing a card force where you force someone to pick the card you want them to pick, or you don't force them. You manipulate the cards in such a way that you know what card they picked.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest way is just pay attention to what card is on the bottom of the deck. And then you cut the cards. You put the person's card they chose on the top of the cut. You cover that up. Well, the card that was on the bottom of the deck is going to come immediately before the card that person picked.
Mm-hmm.
So you just look for that. Like if it were the three of hearts, you look for the three of hearts, next card, that's going to be the one that the person picked.
Uh-huh.
I just did a big reveal on magic tricks, but that's a very basic one. So lots of YouTube videos out there that show how that's done. But anyway, in this case, the examiner is gaming the system. The examiner already knows what the card is.
Yeah.
Does not need to look at the lie detector at all. In fact, the lie detector probably wouldn't even help at all in figuring out which card this was unless someone was just that hyped up about, oh my God, that's my card. No, that's not it. I mean, unless that were to happen, the lie detector wouldn't help you.
Right.
But by establishing that the lie detector is so sensitive and accurate, you have now built into the person's mind that this thing is going to catch you if you lie.
Right.
And then you start the questioning. And since the person now believes that if he or she lies, it's going to be instantly recognizable, they might actually move ahead and just confess. So you've skipped the whole process of having to do a lie detector test in the first place. You've scared the person into confessing a crime. Now, of course, if the person's innocent, that's not going to help at all. You know, you're still going to have to go through the whole thing.
True.
It's only if the person's guilty and willing to confess, if they don't realize that it was all a trick to try and gain their confidence. Now, that's just one method. There are other ways of doing the same sort of thing where you tell a person to lie and then you show them the results on the lie detector and say, see, here's where I asked you to lie and you see where your response is. And that could either be a legitimate test that they're showing them,
mm-hmm.
or it could be a pre-generated test where you're just showing them some lines and saying, see where I asked you to lie and you see these squiggles here. Those may or may not be your squiggles. I'm just saying,
well, those aren't my squiggles.
Right. Yeah. If you're like, no, obviously Jane was in here lying. She's a terrible liar. I'm much better. But yeah, it's essentially deception is what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that every examiner feels that this is necessary or that every examiner even thinks that what they're doing has no merit. I'm sure most of them think that it is a completely legitimate practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the fact remains that it's just measuring your physiological response, which is different for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Though there are some things that people try to do to avoid giving themselves away. Such as taking sedatives or biting their tongue or sticking a tack in their shoe.
There's lots of other very simple ones. Just simple breathing exercises can help mm-hmm. you stay calm. And like I said, again, if you take it so that you tense your muscles a bit when you're truthfully answering a control question. If you tense your muscles, and you just increase your breathing rate a little bit, mm-hmm. that's going to be enough to boost your pulse and to change the respiratory reading to start fouling up the results. It is not hard to learn how to fool a polygraph.
Yeah.
Or at least fooling is probably the wrong word. How to make the results unreadable, mm-hmm. essentially. Because if you make it so that it looks like you're lying to answers that are obviously the truth, they can't rely on the test as a whole.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so controversial, even now after decades of it being in use, and why so many jurisdictions won't allow polygraphs to be submitted.
Yeah, there's still some that will, and some of them will only do it upon the order of a judge.
Mm-hmm.
Like in some jurisdictions, a judge can allow has discretion to allow or not allow lie detector results. I think that using them in any case in that sense, like as evidence, is mm-hmm. terrible. It's just a horrible idea because it's already been proven to be unreliable. You can beat it if you know how. And even if you don't know how, but you are anxious, you can give off false positives. And here's another good example. I meant to mention this with the whole control question versus mm-hmm. the real questions.
Right.
So part of the problem is that you can never really establish a good control versus real question
mm-hmm.
because the control questions aren't going to have the same emotional impact as right. the real questions. Okay. So like a control question might be, do you live at such and such address? Well, there's no emotional attachment there. There's no
right.
sense of risk. There's nothing like that. And you could just say yes. But if they say, did you kill Mr. So-and-so, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's definitely got an emotional attachment to it, whether you did it or not. Just the accusation alone is enough to provoke the fight or flight response in most people. Maybe not even most, but in lots of people. Most is probably too vague a word, but I would think that a lot of people would respond very strongly to that question, whether they had done anything or not, because it's an emotionally charged question. Unless you were able to create control questions that were also emotionally charged,
mm-hmm.
You can't really say that's a baseline. You know, it's like, how was your day? Oh, it was good. Good. Did you skin this person alive and then wear that as a dress? That two different questions, two different levels of...
Now,
for some of us, we can casually answer yes to those, but others, you know, would have a bit of a reaction to that.
Sometimes you frighten me. I just wanted you to know that.
Well, you know what? Spring's right around the corner and fashion time is coming up.
Great.
At any rate, so polygraph tests, I think you can safely say are great for measuring a physiological response. Not great at ascertaining truth versus lies. So it's a misnomer, really. Mm-hmm. It's more of, like Tyler was saying, our guest producer for the day, it's more of a stress test than a lie test. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, not really.
Other than the fact that some pretty major cases kind of came down to lie detector evidence making a big difference.
Wow. Yeah, it's a little hard to imagine that, but,
it's true.
I know,
but
it's true.
In several of the cases, just because someone passes a lie detector test doesn't mean they're innocent. And just because someone fails, it doesn't mean they're guilty.
Right.
Well, it also, if they fail it, they might be guilty. If they pass it, they might be innocent.
Mm-hmm.
So even in cases where lie detector tests were entered into evidence, usually there was other evidence that really contributed to a person's sentence of guilty. that doesn't necessarily mean that no one has ever been falsely imprisoned because of a lie detector test. I haven't done the research on that. I would imagine that it's probably happened, which is unfortunate, but it probably doesn't happen a lot. Still shouldn't happen at all, I know. But anyway.
Yeah. But I'm glad we tackled this one because it's fascinating to think about it. And it's the thing that makes this so different from the Ghost Hunter Tech episode is that, you know, it actually does more or less what it's supposed to, but it's just so unreliable that you can't count on it.
There
is a legitimate reason for wanting to use it.
Right. It does measure things. It's just, like I said, the premise that it's based upon itself is faulty.
Yeah.
That's the problem is when you have a faulty premise, everything else that follows can't be relied upon.
Yeah.
And again, talking about critical thinking. So that's another great example. And yeah, if you guys have other critical thinking kind of topics you would like us to tackle, let us know. Now, we should also point out some people have been suggesting things that really don't fall into the tech field. Since this is tech stuff and not skeptic stuff, we can't just tackle anything as much as I would love to do that. But we do have a sister podcast called Stuff from the Science Lab that just went live not that long ago. And
I'm sure they'd love to talk about some of the scientific.
Yeah, I don't know what their email address is off the top of my head, but as soon as this, by the time this goes live, I'll be sure to make a blog post that points people in the right direction, because I think that that podcast would probably be the best place to tackle skeptical matters that are non-technology oriented. I mean, I'm still going to take the tech ones. I will fight them tooth and nail. But if it's not tech related and you still want to hear about it, that would be a good choice. But that brings us to our second round of listener mail. This listener mail comes from Jason from Maryland, and he says, "Hey guys, I read this and it reminded me of your podcast a bit ago about Easter eggs. I hope all is well. A crazy Easter egg popped up on airfare search site Kayak today. If you try searching for one-way flight from Sydney to Los Angeles to take place on September 22nd, 2010, you'll get the fictitious flight featured on a mysterious TV show called Lost." Which is true. You'll get the Oceanic Airways flight. I've never actually seen an episode of Lost, but I went ahead and tried this anyway, and it did work.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I then was mauled by a polar bear. I have no idea what that's about.
Yeah, I don't either. I haven't watched the show either. So.
Yeah, we're lame. If you want to write and tell us how lame we are, techstuff at howstuffworks.com. Remember, we got the blogs. We got the live show every Tuesday, 1 p.m. Hope you guys are tuning into that. It's been a really fun experience so far. We've managed to alienate Apple fans and Windows fans alike.
All right.
I hope we can continue. I think Linux is next. It all depends on what's in the news.
We'll see.
So tune into that. Read the blogs. Check out the website. Check out this article on how lie detectors work. It's a very good article.
Yeah.
And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the new TechStuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.